WPBM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. 103.7 on your dial and streaming globally at WPVMFM.org.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Simon Gaitan. Peace talks between the United States and Iran failed to make a breakthrough over the weekend, with US President Donald Trump ordering a blockade of Iranian ports. The global oil benchmark Brent crude rose 7% to $102 a barrel, with Asian stocks under pressure on Monday. Laura Westbrook reports from Hong Kong.
Stock markets in South Korea, Japan, and Hong Kong were all down in morning trading, while oil prices rebounded above $100 a barrel as the U.S. moved to impose a blockade on Iranian shipping after peace talks between the U.S. and Iran in Pakistan over the weekend ended without a deal. The reopening of the crucial choke point, the Strait of Hormuz, was a key sticking point in talks between the U.S. and Iran. The U.S. blockade of Iranian ports is aimed at putting pressure on Iran, which has continued shipping oil, with China Iran's biggest buyer of oil.
Hungary is entering a new political era after voters delivered a decisive result in a closely watched election. Péter Magyar, who mounted the most significant challenge to Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's 16 years in power, has won, signalling a major shift in the country's direction and its ties with Europe.
Leaders moved quickly to congratulate Magyar after the vote, with officials across the bloc signaling hopes for closer cooperation and a more aligned relationship with the European Union. Magyar has pledged to restore institutional checks and rebuild ties with Brussels as Hungary's position within the European Union now enters a new phase.
In a sharp diplomatic rebuke, India has rejected China's latest attempt to assign new names to places in areas New Delhi calls part of its northeastern territory. Beijing has renamed at least five places in the last few years, which it claims are part of its South Tibet province. Ishan Gurge reports from New Delhi.
India's Ministry of External Affairs has categorically rejected China's fresh bid to rename locations in the northeastern state of Arunachal Pradesh, calling it an attempt to manufacture baseless narratives that cannot alter ground realities. Spokesperson Randhir Jaiswal said Beijing's actions amounted to a mischievous effort to assign fictitious names to Indian territory and warned the move could derail ongoing efforts to stabilize bilateral ties. China refers to Arunachal Pradesh as Zhangnan or South Tibet and has now renamed places in the region five times since 2017, each exercise dismissed by New Delhi.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks. Looking in more detail today at the economic damage the US and Israeli war on Iran has done to the American economy. Inflation last month ticked up to 3.3% in the United States, a two-year high that many political analysts say will soon cause deep problems for President Trump's fellow Republicans who are running in this November's midterm elections. And the price of petrol at the pumps went up 21.2% in March, the largest monthly increase in nearly 60 years. Megan O'Sullivan, professor of international relations at Harvard University and a former George W. Bush administration official, says that number is good for some in America, but bad for lots of others.
America now being a net exporter of oil means that when the price of oil goes up, it's of huge benefit to U.S. companies. We've seen record amounts of exports of U.S. refined petroleum products. So that accrues to American producers in the American economy. Mm-hmm. What changes is that the distribution of that wealth changes inside of America rather than between America and, say, the Middle East. Consumers bear some of the cost, but producers and companies are benefiting.
She spoke to Foreign Policy magazine. Her book is called Windfall: How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
To recap the top stories, peace talks between the US and Iran failed to make a breakthrough over the weekend, with President Trump ordering a blockade of Iranian ports, with oil prices rising above $100 a barrel on Monday. Viktor Orbán has been defeated in Hungary's elections after 16 years as the Prime Minister. Opposition candidate Péter Magyar won the vote with a record turnout of nearly 80%. and India and China face off over renaming Himalayan towns on their disputed border. That's the latest feature story news. Simon Gaitan reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Mostly sunny across western North Carolina today. A high near 82 here in the city. Partly cloudy skies overhead tonight. The low going down to 54. More sunshine than clouds on Tuesday. A high near 86. Partly cloudy and 55 for Tuesday night. Then on Wednesday, even warmer, mostly sunny, with a high in the upper 80s to near 90. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts from across the country, sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPBM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent, commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant and behavioral health expert. With me today, I have an honored and distinguished guest who I got to meet in person at one of his trainings, is Dr. Michael Gurian. Dr. Gurian is a New York Times bestselling author of 32 books. What do you like? Do you have any free time? Published in 23 languages. As a marriage and family counselor and social philosopher, he has pioneered efforts to bring neurobiology and brain research into homes, schools, corporations, and public policy. Dr. Gurian is co-founder of the Gurian Institute, which conducts research internationally, launches pilot programs, and trains professionals. One of the world's foremost gender experts, Michael travels extensively as a speaker, trainer, and consultant to help professionals, schools, agencies, and organizations better understand and assess the needs of both sexes and all genders, and most effectively intervene and work with children and adults from birth through childhood. Michael has spoken for the United Nations on violence against women, provided information on boys and girls' educational needs to the White House, and briefed members of the 114th Congress on the boy crisis in America. A number of Michael's books have sparked national debate, including The Wonder of Boys, The Wonder of Girls, Boys and Girls Learn Differently in Leadership and the Sexes, co-host of the Wonder of Parenting podcast as well. But today I'm pleased to have him joining us to talk about his latest book, Boys, A Rescue Plan, Moving Beyond the Politics of Masculinity to Healthy Male Development. Dr. Gurian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm going to do a little promo. I got the book. It was not signed. I'll just have to get that later, you know. So.
Thank you.
But, you know, I've gotten to be in a presentation and experience some of your work firsthand, which as a facilitator and a presenter myself, I give you the compliment of really enjoying the entire day and not being bored for one moment. So very engaging and wonderful presentation, but it's also full of a lot of information. And one of the pieces to me was a lot of these statistics about boys specifically. We'll focus on boys for this one, right? But you know, the amount of violence they encounter, the amount of poor educational performance that they suffer from and endure, how many more of them are in jail, how many more of them will suffer from suicide and violent suicide, be successful at it. And there's this wide number of statistics that are out there about how boys and men experience these things at much greater levels than women do, than girls and women. So it's a little startling, because I think that it points at something that you talk about in this book and have talked about at other times, which is the vulnerability of boys and men, and how vulnerability is really difficult for a lot of our society to kind of play with. Like, being a man and being vulnerable, that's not okay, right? Tell me a little, just give us a little bit of the sample of how this found its way into your work and how it became a focus of working with schools and educators and governments and everything else. And you know, feel free to talk about the big three: government, education or academics, and media.
Right.
How did that find its way into your work?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good question. I started out years ago. So we're talking about late 80s, and I was already doing research on, I was very fascinated with what would the genetics be for male-female, because I had lived overseas as a kid via my parents who worked overseas, and wherever I would go, even if we didn't have the language, us little boys were playing with other little boys, and you didn't really need the language, you know, and girls were playing with girls. And I just intuited, right, that there was something going on. And I'm 66. So I'm born in 1958. So I came up in the era where it's all socialization, you know, sex, gender, it's all socialization. And we've seen a resurgence of that kind of academic programming thing the last 5-10 years. And but I knew that couldn't be right. I mean, it couldn't be that I could go to India and we get to India and suddenly I'm playing with boys with no language. But it's very clear that something's going on. So late 80s, starting to try to study what we could know of genetics and then and brain research. So I was trying to get a little brain scans to try to see what are the differences between male and female brain. And if they existed, then they're going to come in on the genetics because we see them worldwide. So they're everywhere, right? So there's got to be something with the XX and the XY. So luckily, there were other people earlier in the 80s who were looking at this in adults. So what I ended up doing is I ended up studying it, discovering it, finding it out, you know, thanks to them. And then I did it for child development. So The Wonder of Boys was my fifth book, and that was in mid-90s, so 30 years ago. And in that book, then I started asserting the brain research and saying, okay, look, we got to look at the fact that this is robust worldwide. Race doesn't matter for this. Culture doesn't matter for this. There are male patterns and female patterns. And one of the, I guess I was sort of the first to say this way back when, was that in the schools, we were losing our boys. The girls are doing much better than the boys in school. And here are the reasons in terms of male brain, the mismatch of the male brain with the school system. Now, in that era, mid-90s, that was the era of girls are in trouble. Girls are falling behind. Boys have everything. Boys are doing great. Right. So I was sort of counterculture saying this was in The Wonder of Boys, saying, I have two daughters. Obviously, I support girls and women. Of course, we do. I'm a good feminist, but we're missing something here.
Right.
The boys are actually the ones who are struggling much more. They get 70% of the D's and F's. And what's happening now was true 30 years ago. You know, that has not really changed. In some areas, it's gotten worse. The male test scores are not as good as female. The male discipline referrals to principal, vice principal, head of school, assistant head of school, those are, you know, off the charts compared to girls. The amount of violence that boys are experiencing, you know, and you listed it, suicide. And then I started talking about male type depression, that's different than female type depression. So what I've been trying to do is, because of this initial kind of intuition based on my childhood that something must be going on that's transcultural, that's, you know, genetic, that's brain-based in terms of male-female and the application of it to child development, that we could develop assets to help boys and girls. So right around then, we did a two-year pilot at the Gurion Institute was formed, and we did a two-year pilot out of University of Missouri, Kansas City, six school districts there, and kind of proved the thesis that, okay, if we train teachers, therapists, counselors, you know, everybody in the big three, which I call academics, government, media, if we could get them trained in this male-female brain difference and how robust and powerful this is, then the systems could shift and we could get systems to pay attention to this. Right. And therefore, then the systems could serve the kids better. And so primary systems, I've done corporate and so on, but primary systems, you know, where I'm known for would be in school systems, counseling, you know, anything having to do with where we as adults meet boys and girls, you know, women and men. And of course, so starting all the way back with Wonder of Boys, I already was arguing, as we know, that there's a spectrum for male and female. So you have, and those are folks who would now show up as gender fluid, trans, intersex, that there's a spectrum. But at the same time, male and female brains scan so differently that even, you know, we can even look at trans scans and we can see everything. So it started with an intuition, and then it led to research overseas, and then it led to
Went to brain scans.
Brain scans, yeah. I want everything to be scan based. Like I want all of my work to be science based.
Yeah, well, and it, you know, to a certain extent, not, you know, gender is important. The differences between genders are important, but if you take a brain scan, what you're looking at, you know, you might see it. I might not see it. A layperson's definitely not going to see it. Teachers probably won't see it, but I'm looking at a brain scan. I don't know whether that's male or female. Well, what I can tell you about this brain scan is this person's going to respond to this kind of educational environment versus this one better. And, you know, I came out of the master's in education, but in experiential ed, and we always tried to address these differences through, you know, Kolb's learning styles. You know, you've got all these different kinds of learners in a classroom. Let's try and figure out a way to address, to engage in a process that engages all learners. I think you've gotten a little further to the base where it's, you know, you've got genders in a classroom and they operate differently. They socialize differently. They learn differently. You know, just simple things like boys easier learn to write if they get to draw first, and just yep. little pieces like that. I mean, we always ran into the barrier that teachers were worried they're going to have to implement this whole new curriculum design there in their classroom. And like, we can't do that, you know, but if they just have this basic information, it's like, look, just walk to your learner and know that there's some differences. You got a few tricks here that can help you make that person a better educated individual and be more successful in their academic. You know, and we could go even further. You know, a young boy who becomes successful in academics versus failing in academics becomes someone who's probably better socialized, more well-liked, has better self-esteem. Like, they end up being more successful adult, largely because they don't suffer from these often traumatic events that are involved in failing in academics early on. So the piece that I really wanted to do, and I really enjoyed reading the book, but the quote that I pulled out of here, and I think it speaks to not only what is it that happens to men in, or to boys in the classroom, right? But to men in general. And you talk about the ideology, the fragility of males is right in front of us. We're missing it.
Yep.
But we neglect and avoid it. The dominant themes of toxic masculinity and masculine privilege have a bit of worth, but they don't solve the social problems because they dismiss the fragile male, the boy who is suffering, and the man who is adrift. And I pull that quote out because toxic masculinity is such, it's this big terminology that we've got going on. I always tell people, and something I appreciate about the work that's here is that, you know, let's move towards something, not away from something. You know, we can talk about what we don't want to be, but what do we want to be? And so, you know, in your mind, and my question to you is, there's the toxic masculinity male, the uber male, this alpha overdone kind of version that, you know, where a male's not supposed to become, or if they, well, depending on the circle you sit in, right? And then there's the fragile male that we dismiss and everything else. Who's the male that exists in your mind in between these two kinds of poles where they're healthy and they're adapted and they feel like they feel like they belong in the world? What does that look like to you? What's this health? What's a version of healthy male? What would you say about that?
Well, whenever I'm asked, you know, what is a man,
right.
I always say a man is, and it will answer the question, a man is a loving, wise, and successful male adult. So every one of us, you know, who are XY, who have a Y, we're going to grow up, go through puberty. We're going to become male adults, right? Because our bodies will, and our brains will change. But will we be loving, wise, and successful? So that's the man part. A man mm-hmm. is a loving, wise, and successful male adult. And the approach, you know, as you know, that I take to this is not to spend much time on masculinity. I know it's very popular, as you've expressed, and as you quoted from the book, I know it's very popular. The big three loves it. Academics, government, and media love it.
Right.
But it doesn't really have much to do with what's going on with our boys. And it's a social frame, and it, you know, it's a sociological frame, basically,
right.
And it goes along with, started in feminist sociology about 50-some years ago, and we've all put it to good use. There's good use to it, but it doesn't really get at what boys are experiencing, and just saying, well, either the reason boys do bad things is because of too much masculinity, or the reason they don't grow up is because of too little masculinity. Really, either way is very soft.
Yeah.
So
a poor way to address it either way, right?
What boys are trying to do, right, is they're trying to become good men. So they're trying to become loving, wise, and successful good, you know, men. And for them to do that, right, we have to raise them. So the whole system has to raise them well. The family system has to raise them well. And, you know, from the book and, you know, all the way back in Wonder of Boys, I'm talking about, if we want to be these good men, we got to raise them in a three family system. We got to have a nuclear family, an extended family, and a tribal family. And they got to have male influence in all three of those families, especially once they hit puberty and adolescence. Here's the science of why. There's a lot of really good science around that, brain science. And so they got to have that. Then the educational system has to see them as males and has to raise them or educate them, mentor them as males so that they also become loving, wise, and successful male adults. And then counseling systems, right, have to, we, as you know, I come from the psych field and the education field.
Right.
We in the psych field have to counsel them as, you know, to become loving, wise, and successful male adults. And maybe 5% of what we will do will be talking to them about masculinity. 95% of it is we got to work with them as males. So we have to like change our counseling systems. You know, we can't be having them sit for 50 minutes. Ain't going to work. They're going to leave counseling. It's not a fit for their brain. Right? It's a mismatch of their brains with our system. And the school is the same. Sit, listen, not a good match for male brain. And so the educational system also has to help them become loving, wise, and successful. And so that means changing classrooms, at what, you know, what I call systemic change, which is that they don't need a new curriculum. You're very right. You know, they don't need a $2 million curriculum to do math in such and such a way. What they need is, and it costs very, very little, is they just need systemic change. They need to see the brain scans, get the training, stuff that they should have had if we didn't have all of this kind of sociological argument in college. They would have seen the brain scans when they went to college and grad school, and you and I would have seen them at grad school and college. And then we would be able to set up our systems to do better for both girls and boys, women and men. So it's a mismatch of the male brain with our systems, the systems that are generated through the big three. That's the mismatch. It's not really, you know, it's not really much about masculinity, even though we love to talk about it.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, you're saying it, of course, it's recognize and acknowledge that there are differences. Like we're even struggling with that piece to a certain extent in our systems today. There's this recognition and acknowledgement that there's this difference, and that difference can be, you know, if you're a teacher or if you're a parent, that you can be effective in acknowledging that there's a difference here. And there's a way I might treat my son or my son versus my daughter. This boy in a classroom versus a girl in the classroom. And, you know, now we trip into the hot and delicate territory of gender fluidity. Right. I want to bring to bear kind of comparative ideologies here and get your response to it, because in truth, you've already responded to this. I love it. And I've got a quote in the book that I like to bring out, but, you know, I won't give him too much credit, but you know, you've got Jordan Peterson out there, and I think he doubles down on a lot of the masculinity stuff. He makes some points that are not necessarily in error. And one of them that he talks about, he does it at length in a variety of ways, but you know, you've got a gender fluidity, and you've got members of the LGBTQ community that are identifying, you know, this individual, may they a boy or girl, they feel they're a boy and they feel like they're a girl, and that individual is trapped in a body from birth, you know, and they're just trying to emerge. And that is there's an idea about that as gender identity. But then there's sex. You know, what is your gender? What, you know, what biological organs do you have? What does your brain scan look like? And they tend to get mashed together. Jordan will go in and he'll say, you know, one is a social construct, gender fluidity, and gender is a social contract, whereas sex is not. Sex is a biological, you know, is something that you have biologically and that exists with you. But then all of a sudden the argument starts to get hyperbolic. It starts to take sides and everything else. And this is where I would probably pull out your quote, which I really like, having a personal experience with transgender children myself. As a child advocate, And this was something you did in response to somebody who was arguing with you. As a child advocate, I'm an advocate for all children, including trans, gay, intersex, and gender nonconforming. But human sex exists in 2024 and now 2025 just as much as it did in the past and as much as it will in the future. It is an immutable biological reality that predates our present experiments with gender. The term cisgender is not accurate to that reality because of the assumption that sex as a culture construct. Gender is a culture construct, but sex is not. And I think you see a lot of people having strong reactions to that. And I really love the way that you talk about it in this book. How is it that you bring this to government and education and everything else? How do you soften the blow, so to speak, and give it to them in a way that feels approachable, but also doesn't disregard this fluidity piece that we know exists in our community today, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I advocate, as you know, in this book, more than in any other previously, is that we stop using as much as possible in the big three. So academics, government, and media, which means spreading through the whole society.
Right.
We stop pitting sex and gender against each other. And we use the term sex gender. So instead of, you know, saying gender, which is what the term that's used for everything now, right?
Right.
We say sex gender because sex does come first. It always will, right? It has for a million years, it will for another however many million years. So sex comes first, it's wired in. And gender is a social construct, as you've noted. And the social construct comes second. So 30 years ago, just like now, we knew all about the spectrum, right? And what I posited then was that we should use the term bridge brain for what now we call gender fluidity, and that will really, really help kids. At the same time, trans is a different category because we can scan trans brains, and you know, Boys of Rescue Plan has all of this research in there, so right. People can look at it. We can scan trans brains, and we can see that up to 30 brain centers in a trans brain are operating like the other sex, right? So they may have a male body and genitalia, but their brain is operating much more like a female brain. So that's an extreme bridge brain. So right. A gender fluid person is a bridge brain. They're not trans. They're a bridge brain. They're somewhere in between in their own minds. They're kind of in between. They're still female. They're still male, but there's a wide spectrum of what is female. 4 billion people are female, right? So wide spectrum of female brain. And we can scan it and see it. And then wide spectrum of male brain, we can scan it and see it. And gender fluid is kind of in the middle, not trans, but kind of in the middle. So bridge brain. And I think it's much healthier to help a gender fluid person and say, oh, you're, you know, let's look. Okay, you're not trans.
Right.
You're saying you're trans, but actually you're not. We can see that you're not trans. This is a confusion of language. You're a bridge brain. And just know that, and we accept you as that. So you don't have to assert. You don't have to assert gender and take it over to trans right. when you're not trans, which can lead. If you're trans, that leads to a whole other medical situation. Let's look at you as gender fluid. Let's look at the social construct that you like, the gender roles you like. We'll look at that with you. Trans will be here, and intersex also. You know, we've got around, we don't know, 2-3 million Americans who are intersex. That's specific. You have both sets of genitalia potentially, or your XXYXYY. So that affects your brain. So you're intersex. So these are actually different categories, but sex always comes first. So the movement to make everything gender is where we get in trouble and where we do things medically that we shouldn't be doing, you know, on children, shouldn't be doing those things mm-hmm. on children. Right. They're children. They're 12 years old.
Right.
They may have heard from someone that they're trans now, but
maybe they lock onto something that somebody said and they want to, you know, do that too, right?
Yeah, most of them are not trans. It's social contagion and it's bad terminology. They're not trans. Again, we can scan a trans brain and see trans. They're gender fluid. They would be bridge brains. So what I do, as you know, is I take a very moderate approach. I just try to get everyone to look at all the actual categories, like LGBT. You know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, that's wired in. We knew that all the way back 30 years ago. So that's wired in. That isn't that, you know, that's its own category. And of course, we're going to give equal rights to people who are LGBT. It's wired in. just the way heterosexuality is wired in. Trans is wired in, intersex is wired in, gender fluidity, that's much more of a bridge brain. And so I'm trying to help everyone look at all the categories. Right. Because saying just gender, which is what we do for everything, is getting us in all sorts of trouble. So therefore, we are not actually taking care of our boys. We're not taking care of our girls who are sex, right? That's sex. We are not taking care of our men. We are not taking care of our women. That's sex. We got to make sure to remember that sex is the baseline. So if we mismatch our systems to males or females anywhere, we're mismatching to their sex. And then gender, social construct comes later. We include that.
Well, and it, you know, I think here's a good metaphor or a good, comparative. It's like if you've got a, let's say you've got an individual, an adult that is transitioned and they were female to male and they transit, you know, they were able to get half the surgery, but they haven't gotten all the surgery. If for some reason, and maybe, you know, there was a shortage on testosterone and so on and so forth, and suddenly they, their menstrual cycle returns and you got to go to the doctor. Well, you probably want to go to a doctor who knows something about menstrual cycles if that's where your issue exists. Regardless of how you identify, regardless of the thing that you've tried to make changes in and do all those things, we're not arguing any of that with you. But if you're going to go get medical care for this, that organ is a female organ. And you need to go to somebody who knows how to work with and treat a female organ. And, I think we bring that, bring this back to the brain, right? All of a sudden, it's like if we look at the brain and we stop getting in trouble with this terminology, then we can actually address people kind of where they live. And just like with we know that brain development, that, you see in children this lots of neurodendritic activity. A lot of it, and as we grow older, you lose neurons, you pathways start to solidify, and you've got this brain development piece that happens for folks. So even in a brain that is bridge-brained, it might lean in one direction or in another and start to form, if you will, right? And because the brain, neuroplasticity is one of the great discoveries of our century, ultimately, that we know that the brain can change and it can do remarkable and wondrous things in both directions. The question I have for you is, in the world, outside of environments that we hopefully can control, we don't always do it well, and your work is helping people do it well, but a school environment or a classroom environment is a controlled environment. The media environment is not a controlled environment. It's designed for completely alternative purposes. So let's say for the bridge brain that lives out in the world, that is trying to find, we're talking about maybe a young adult, early teen, mid to late teens, trying to find an identity. And we know, from attachment theory, we're talking about identity at these ages being really, really important and things that can go awry if they're not done well. So we've got an individual, maybe they're bridge brained and they're trying to find an identity and they're arguing with this set of people or with a parent about what they're called, what gender they're being identified for. How are you educating parents on navigating that piece?
Yeah. I do it the same way I do in my counseling practice. It's a both and, of course. I mean, right. You're still your sex and you're probably a bridge brain. So trying to get everyone the language, like with clients, I try to figure out, and parents can do this too. That's part of why I write these books, so parents can read them and educators, so that you can grab it. And one of the things parents can use is you're probably a bridge brain. You're saying you're trans, son or daughter. You're saying you're trans. The likelihood is you're a bridge brain. If you have gender dysphoria, that's dysphoria, which is depression. So we can treat that
right
by looking at who you are. And if you get out of all of this language stuff that's confusing, let's just look at your brain. It's your brain that's depressed, right? It's your brain body that's depressed. Let's go there.
This is a condition. Let's treat the condition.
Gender dysphoria. It's dysphoria, yeah. Right? So let's try to help you. And bridge brain is a way to help you. So it seems like you're a bridge brain, and here are the qualities of a bridge brain, you know, which are going to be sort of the same qualities of someone who is saying they're gender fluid. And then somewhere in there, we as parents are going to be talking with the caregivers and saying, does my child have gender dysphoria or brain sex dysphoria? So brain sex dysphoria is another thing that I'm advocating that we take into our DSM. Doesn't exist now. Everything's gender dysphoria. So that's right. Just creates a lot of problems for parents, for therapists, for educators, for everyone. Everything is gender dysphoria. Gender is a social construct. The term is not right for what is actually going on with our kids. But if we want to use it, okay, let's differentiate gender dysphoria from brain sex dysphoria. A trans person has brain sex dysphoria. They are depressed because their brain sex does not match their reproductive biology.
Right.
And that is a much more significant disorder, and much more can lead to suicide, let's say, than gender dysphoria, which is I'm a bridge brain and I don't fit. And I'm
not sure which way to lean. Fit. Right.
Yeah. Well, and the great thing about a bridge brain is you don't have to pick, you know, the parents and the teachers and the therapists and the psychiatrists, everyone is looking and saying, yeah, but you're not trans. You're a bridge brain. So part of what has to happen is parents and the whole system parents have to help school systems and everyone get re-educated toward what's actually going on. And so rather than everyone getting educated toward everything's gender dysphoria, and so when you have gender dysphoria, you immediately go into gender affirming care, we have to look at educate the systems, and parents can advocate for this, educate the systems so that they can differentiate. And as the parents and the kids differentiate, the systems differentiate. So then the systems will understand what care to give which child. And the systems will then, you know, the parents will advocate and say, I do think my child has brain sex dysphoria, or I do think my child has gender dysphoria, but not brain sex dysphoria. And then the systems will do brain scans and will look and see, okay, you have, right. you actually are trans. You have, a brain sex dysphoria, and in the majority of cases, of kids who present with gender dysphoria, the systems will look at them and say, okay, you have gender dysphoria, not brain sex dysphoria. So gender affirming care, what we call that, which is we're going to start you on biological interventions, actually not a fit for you, right? Because you're not trans. So not a fit for you. We're going to do these other things. And parents, which is going to be, you know, medication, counseling, you know, and parents need to be advocating for that. And this thing that happened, like in the state of California, where parents are not going to be told, so the school doesn't have to tell the parents if a child comes in and says, well, I have gender dysphoria.
Hey, right.
Okay, that is not a good move. I mean, Of course, there's going to be backlash.
California's making a lot of mistakes these days.
Challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, the parents need to be involved helping their kids. And as the parents get educated, then they won't overreact. They'll understand that this is a both and, you know.
They might. Some do. But, you know, I think we're talking about trying to make societal change is what we're talking about, right?
Right. And we got to educate everyone. It's just like with gay, lesbian, LGBT or gay, you know, I mean, 30 years ago, parents were overreacting to that much more than they are now.
Yeah.
Some still do.
Stages
but much
have changed.
Less.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. We have been able to educate and say, hey, this is hardwired. Here's how it works. You know, please do not be overreacting to this. Please support your child. And most parents are. There are still some who overreact, but most parents are. Well, the same has to happen here with sex gender. We got to get everyone educated in what's actually going on because there's so much variety in the brain. And well, to your point about neuroplasticity, let me just say this.
Oh, yeah,
thing.
Please.
Sex gender is not highly plastic. Right. So sex on the brain is not highly plastic. So when we talk about neuroplasticity, right, as you know, we're talking about we can train the brain to do these different things and it'll create bypasses. Right. We'll have different synapses will fill into different
damage the brain
pathways.
It out. Right.
Yeah. Especially trauma. You know, you have neuroplasticity. You can create different pathways. But sex is hardwired on the genes in utero. So we come out with the sex on our brain. So I don't want listeners to think, okay, well, you know, because I say I'm gender fluid, I am now, because I say that, I'm rewiring my brain for sex. I'm not.
A bridge brain person, an individual might decide they want to identify as a certain gender. that doesn't necessarily make their brain different in the way that it was in utero. Is that, would that be,
yeah, they still have statement? A bridge brain is also hardwired in utero. So, right, the spectrum is hardwired in utero. And it's just that as we grow up, we learn who we are and we see where we fit on the spectrum. And you'll have some people who are extreme male on the spectrum. The great example would be action stars in, you know, of course, the individuals are not that, but
your classic masculine male, right?
If you see an Arnold Schwarzenegger, what you're seeing, let's say, is you're seeing someone who we would just use as icon of extreme male brain, even though Arnold Schwarzenegger isn't necessarily, but the Terminator or whoever he's playing, that would be extreme male brain, and you're going to see this develop. That brain is not going to use as many words. It's not going to connect as many words to feelings as even the average male brain is. It's going to be more spatial mechanical, more visual graphic, more physical, more cerebellum dependent, way out on the one end. And then, then you move and you move and you move and you get closer to the middle. And then you have, okay, I'm a bridge brain. Okay, well, how do I know I'm a bridge brain? If I'm male, the way I know I'm a bridge brain is that I can connect more words to feelings more quickly. So my words to feeling ratio not only is more rapid, but it has more depth. So the more that a male brain moves toward bridge brain, the more we measure word to feeling ratios, because that's the best way to know if this is a bridge brain.
Word to feeling ratios.
Because you can still have very physical, athletic bridge brain males. And for females, the same. The extreme female brain, we know, is the brain that is what we call ultra feminine, if we wanted to use those language, but it's that brain that didn't get actually a lot of the testosterone and androgenic chemical. And so that brain is way out on soft color, high word to feeling ratio, not spatial. So spatial is objects moving through space, not spatial, way out on the extreme. And then the more females get toward the bridge, they would have gotten a little more testosterone and then there we look at them now and they look at themselves. And corporate world loves this stuff because a lot of the bridge brain females go, oh yeah, I'm really spatial. I don't use as many words. I'm still female, but I'm more like what I think of as a male brain or what you, Gurian, just showed me brain scans of as a male brain. And she's a bridge brain and she knows it. And so that stuff's hardwired in.
Right.
And the soft wiring is how the opportunities we give it and how it works in the world.
The nurture.
But it's already hardwired. Right. So it's not, sex is not neuroplastic.
Okay. I mean, that's a good distinction. The funny thing is that I ran into the brain scans, and you use these in your presentation, of course. Yeah. I ran into them prior to that because I've got family members who are transgender and the UCSF Child and Adolescent Gender Center, which is, doing a lot of research, but a lot of what they're doing when they're advising families who are coming in about, should we, and this is a lot, and this is a topic I'd love to hear your opinion about, but if you got a child that's gender dysphoria, sex dysphoric, and they do a brain scan, and like, yeah, well, your little girl that's, got all the markers of having the sex of a female does in fact have what we see in the averages, a male brain. And that's why they feel this way. And it's linked to the affirmations and whether or not, drugs should be used before the age of 16 and 17 and all those kinds of things. Like their research is asking these questions and applying brain research to it and saying, these are the things that should inform any decision, regardless of the age, et cetera. Which is a pretty sophisticated way to go about it. You ask the average family, hey, you need to go get some brain scans when you're facing these issues. It could be an expensive thing to go get. It's a fairly sophisticated thing to kind of engage in until it becomes normalized and everything else. What is your thought about you've got an individual that is gender dysphoric, or excuse me, sex dysphoric. They are born one sex and feel like the other. Being under the age of, say, 16, 17, 18, or 19, and engaging in hormones and surgeries and so on and so forth. You know, there's a fairly large population of folks that say, hey, don't touch them until everything sorts itself out, 18 or 19 years of age. Then you've got a smaller population of people that are affirming as soon as this individual starts saying things like this, you want to start affirming those things, and that even includes, et cetera, you know, surgeries and hormones and et cetera. What are your